Well, hello there, and a somewhat muted and somber welcome to the latest edition of the DF Direct Q&A show. This is actually the second time we've recorded this introduction because we've reached the point where the cataclysmically bad news outpaces our effectively bi-weekly schedule for podcast-style content. But here we are, the full scale of Microsoft's layoffs, divestments, and what we think are some pretty terribly short-sighted decisions mean that we're expanding the scope of this show to talk about that before we move on to our previously recorded show. So joining me, first of all, John Inman. Hello.
Hey, Rich.
Hello. And Will Giard. Hi.
Hey, Rich.
Okay, so thanks for those muted and somber responses. I guess it's fully on brand for this particular show. Okay, so let's get straight into it, John. There are many components to this particular Microsoft layoff round. It all looks pretty grim. 3,200 people affected. These layoffs are going to be occurring in phases. In fact, why don't you take it from the top? What's actually going on here? Because it is unprecedented, isn't it? And holy crap, it's bad.
Yeah, so they kind of started by saying this is like what the largest restructuring in Xbox history. So like 10 years on from the greatest lineup in Xbox history, we have the most devastating, you know, series of layoffs and restructuring and resetting in the history of the company. And it's not good. And essentially, so starting with, I guess, the reasons that does seem that they basically admit, as many of us always suggested, Game Pass, not a success. It was not a sustainable business model, right? And as expected, it required them to essentially subsidize that entire thing, subsidize the studios to create content for it. That didn't work out. She basically tossed away the last 10 years of Xbox and saying, oh yeah, all of this failed.
They're basically
saying it was expected.
Yeah,
they don't have the users.
They're basically saying that the that there's the implication there that the choices made in the studios acquired and the way those studios were then subsequently run was basically not great for business, right?
Correct. Yeah, she specifically says that studio acquisitions were not necessarily positive. It's like not desirable or possible to own them all. Something I think we could all agree with. But the, you know, obviously that was a big part of the last few years or last 10 years of Xbox. And I kind of regret ever sharing any positive feelings on those acquisitions. I don't think that turned out to be a good thing at all. But there are some things to come out of it in terms of less horrible things. They have indeed divested themselves of certain studios. So Compulsion Games and Double Fine, for instance, they have been returned to independence, so to speak. And thankfully, they seem to be able to keep their intellectual property. So they're actually getting a pretty good deal out of this. And it looks like Ninja Theory and Undead Studios, the State of Decay guys, there's some kind of new partnership stuff in the works. They seem like they will continue. So they're also not dead, which is good. There is discussion around Arkane, which one of my favorite studios. I know they've perhaps we've seen rumors of them having some issues getting Blade finished, unfortunately. But thankfully, French law helps protect them. So Microsoft's American companies can't just come in and clean house like they do in the US. And that's currently being discussed. So we don't yet know what their fate holds. So all of this stuff is to say that they've decided to get rid of some of those studios, but they are at least doing it rather than just saying close the door. They found a way to keep them going, as tricky as that is. But then I guess the part that we weren't, you kind of expected it, but like I think the news around studio closure was dominating the rumor cycle up to this point, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But we also expected layoffs, but they're actually kind of a lot worse than I expected, I must admit. So essentially, I think it's like 3,200 layoffs total in Xbox somewhere. It's over 3,000. And yep. They said they're doing half of that now, half of that by the end of fiscal year 2027, which quite frankly, I think it's absolutely fair to say that this is psychological warfare on their employees. It's extremely terrible to do this to people. Nobody knows what's next. Everything becomes risk averse. Hiring freezes. People that are already overworked are going to be asked to do way more work, and it might not matter. Managers on the defense. Like, it just creates this chaotic, awful environment. Like, I don't understand the point of this, because what will this accomplish in terms of actually producing any sort of meaningful content for them? Not much, I'd imagine. Some of the studios affected, Obsidian, ZeniMax Online, and the big one, I think, is id Software.
Yeah, that's the shocking thing, right, John? The concept that not just the concept that they're taking the axe to id Software, but where they're taking the axe to id Software. It's kind of like, this is what I was talking about when it comes to being short-sighted in terms of that introduction that just talked about earlier. It's basically the point where you've got effectively one of the best engine businesses, one of the best engineering departments in the entire games business, gone, effectively, from what we understand. Gone. Which means that, you know, if they want to exploit the IPs that id Software is famous for, Doom, Quake, etc., either they're going to be using the existing technology that they've got, or they're going to be moving on to another engine. We don't even know at this point. I mean, there's some talk out there that id Software will effectively become a support studio, which is like one of the worst things ever. I mean, what do you make of all of this?
Yeah. I wish they could have spun them off
right,
and somehow become independent again, because this is a gigantic, colossal blow for the industry, not only for its history. And the id Software today is not the same as the original, but they operate in much the same way. And they bring technical excellence, research and development, and techniques that benefit everyone in the gaming space. Truly a god-tier developer. One of my favorites in the business. And I mean, I said earlier, if they messed with id, I could never forgive them. And I don't think I can. This is the worst thing Xbox has ever done for me personally, and a direct insult to the medium. And it shows the leadership knows nothing and cares nothing about the industry. They are here to make money exclusively, and they will do it by any means necessary. And I can see why. If you look at the Excel sheet or you ask Copilot, be like, oh, id Software releases one game every like 4 or 5 years, and they have this big custom engine. Why, you know, so let's just cut all that and spend less money and be done with it. You know, either they support studio, I doubt it. They just make things differently. I just don't understand how even they could achieve that. They said they want to keep the IP. They want more Doom and Wolfenstein, whatever games, but they want it more often and they want to leverage that IP. But you cut half the studio. Who the hell is going to make this, Rich? Who's going to make this? What's the point? Like, what are they even doing? Like, just if you're going to do that, get rid of the IP, sell the damn studio. Like, this is so stupidly insulting to everything. Like, I am extremely upset about this. And obviously, there is a personal stake in here as well. I mean, I know a lot of the people there. I know what they're capable of. It's the worst thing that's ever happened in this, like, I don't understand it. Like, business wise, again, they had, I don't think management actually cares about making good stuff anymore. Like, I think that's over, but let's say they did. Let's say they actually cared about games. You look at a company like Capcom, right? What they've done with their RE engine and MT framework before it, they've built world-class technology that powers all of their games. They've managed to build something truly great that is theirs to own. They've invested in it. Their studios use it. They leverage their talent and their resources to do this, and it does save money in the end, and it creates great results, and it cuts out that middleman. There's a lot there. They could have found a way to leverage id Software in this way, I believe. That engine has found its way into other games already. But, you know, you don't just take the id Software, the id Tech as we know now, but you transform this into something that could build a better platform for more games. I think there would have been potential there. I mean, you have some of the smartest engineers in the world in terms of 3D rendering, like, working for you. Use it. But again, this is just one of those things. They're looking at the numbers. They don't know. They don't care. They just want to cut numbers. Like, this is just a fire sale. Just get rid of everything. Make money. But it's typical short-sighted Microsoft stuff.
Right.
This is why they've been scrambling so bad for so long. They don't know how to plan for the future. And they do make money as a company, but when you start to dig into it, you see like just the amount of mistakes and waste that they make despite the profits in other areas. It's really absurd.
Going back to the id Software thing, I actually think their cadence of games has been actually very, very good. I mean, Doom 2016,
yeah.
the new trilogy, 2016. It's been 10 years, three games, three excellent games with expansions. What more could you expect?
And they've created technology that supported other games,
yep.
Like Indiana Jones, all the machine game stuff, you know, Arkane Studio, they worked with them on Dishonored, you know. That's about the best you could hope for. I mean, and you could have improved that. You could have found ways to improve that even, but like, that's freaking outstanding what they've done. Just what a stellar, like, rewarding technical excellence, great scheduling, great production, you know, actually creating great games, rewarding them with this. Games don't matter to Xbox anymore. It's over.
Well, what's your take on all of this?
Oh, I mean, what is there to say that hasn't already been said? But I mean, yeah, it's just really disappointing news. It feels like, you know, we kind of expected something would be going on based on the reset memo last month. And I think, you know, it is smart to divest themselves of studios that don't quite fit their business model or what their new business model will be. But I think, you know, gutting all these teams that we know are doing good work, especially id, just feels like, again, it's, you know, we're trying to reduce costs, we need to do something pretty soon, and so we're just gonna, you know, get rid of the stuff that we don't quite understand or don't quite need at this particular moment. It doesn't feel like it's part of a cohesive strategy for the next 5 years and the next 10 years. It's, you know, what will look good for the investors in the next year. And yeah, having these layoffs just hanging over people, you know, it's going to be impossible for them to regroup and say, okay, well, we might have, you know, 25% of our staff or 50% of our staff, but, you know, I guess we can do a different project, or we can turn two projects into one and we can make something out of it. Now there's going to be another round of layoffs at some stage over the next year. And yeah, it just feels a bit hopeless. I mean, I'm sure everyone in these studios is just going to feel like, you know, a complete lack of faith in the management above them. And, you know, nobody's going to be doing their best work based on that, right? Like, we've all had a bit of experience of being in a place where the people that are making the decisions don't quite understand or quite, you know, have the same values as you. And it's just difficult to do your best. So yeah, it's really unfortunate and really challenging, and I can't really find many positive things to say, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, the divestment side of things is probably the best case scenario for the likes of Ninja Theory, exactly. Compulsion and Double Fine. But let's make things perfectly and abundantly clear here. They're moving out of what was effectively a sort of gated environment that historically had looked after them, where they didn't really need to worry about chasing the next contract, that sort of thing. But now they're back where they were, into the situation which kind of led to them being acquired by Microsoft in the first place, where you never quite know who's going to be publishing your next game. And, you know, the longevity of the studio is almost, you know, you're moving on a sort of job by job basis there. Mm. And that is a precarious place to be in the current era. But based on the alternative being either mass layoffs or shutdown, obviously, it's the preferable way forward. Ah, dear. I mean, we've obviously, sorry, we've also had word from Bethesda about, you know, their sort of strategy going forward, basically a more collective approach to game making and focusing on their key franchises. What do you make of that, John?
Oh, you mean like Doom and you got Obsidian. I think they were making some big new games. I hear one of them was in one of their big franchises. They've got a lot of layoffs there. I think Elder Scrolls Online was doing pretty good. They gutted that team. I don't know, man. We'll see what they can do with that. I don't know what they mean by big franchise. And, you know, maybe we do, though, because Mojang, that's how you say it, the Minecraft company, and King, Candy Crush people, they're now reporting directly to Asha. And this makes me think that what they really want here is a business where you have a strong creator ecosystem, you have recurrent spending, you have persistence, games that last forever, and low cost content growth, essentially free labor. I think they kind of want a Roblox.
Right.
You know, and Minecraft already kind of is to some degrees, but it's still far more limited. But the problem is like they already tossed out that investor bait with the 1 billion daily users thing, which even Roblox itself, it's like upwards of maybe 150 million daily users, which is insanely high and way beyond just about everything else. But Minecraft and Candy Crush together maybe match up to Roblox by itself, but that's their biggest properties for that sort of thing. I mean, I guess if they want to lump other entertainment stuff in there, whatever, maybe they get there by messing around with the numbers. But the thing is, though, is that she looks at Minecraft and Candy Crush and stuff and thinks, yes, our future is these games that have been around for 20 years. And yeah, they do still make a lot of money. They're very successful. But it also feels like these are older products. They may not continue forever. And there's no clear sign of innovation or an attempt to really go beyond this. I mean, Fortnite was huge. It's less huge than it used to be. It is falling off. And that can happen here. I don't think it will last. Roblox is special and very unique because of specifically the way that's built, because it is not just a single game. It is a thing. And I think making something like that, if you say, I want to make the next Roblox, I don't think Microsoft could do it. I don't think any other company can just say, we're going to make the next Roblox and actually pull it off. No. This is not something you do in a normal development cycle. This is a long-term, very, 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 very difficult thing to achieve, and it relies on the whims of children. Like, good luck investing in that. But I saw this anecdote yesterday that made me think, and it kind of fits in with what I've always thought about these sort of like management people. So it's from Dan Callan, who worked on Halo 4. He was basically put this, he says, I have a very distinct memories of having to demo Halo 4 for Don Matrick and realizing that these people just live on different planes of reality. I was showing off my mission, and when the Mantis showed up with its cool intro vignette, he raised his hand and said to the group, has anyone here played Diablo 3? He then went on to suggest we should copy their idea of a real money auction house for campaign mech skins. And every single person around him reacted like it was an amazing, groundbreaking idea, while simultaneously realizing this was the stupidest shit imaginable, since everyone with a brain had seen how hard that blew up in their face, and Halo 4 was 90% done, but they still had to act like it was a good idea and make pretense that they were making action items. So you hear this, and you think about the way these people are thinking, the way they look at it, and then you look at, again, a company like Nintendo that's cultivated talent for decades. You know, the way they run their business and they treat their properties and the people working on them is so fundamentally different. They're not chasing the same quick buck in the same way. I mean, yeah, they've done a lot of things that maybe rub people the wrong way, but they just fundamentally focus on sustainability and trusting their teams to make things, and it works. This approach, this sort of like American business smash things, get stuff done kind of approach, it doesn't work, and Xbox is the proof. And I think Osh's just doing more of the same, and it's probably not going to succeed. I think the better solution here would have been to try to keep Xbox and Microsoft as a large games publisher. I think there's decisions they could have made here to turn things around as far as like making the business sustainable, not, you know, bleeding red. Because, yeah, Microsoft's not going to subsidize them forever. I get that. You can't expect that. I do still, I feel like this is just, they've taken an axe to things. And these are cuts made by people that have no idea how these studios actually run and what they do. And I've talked to people about this, and like the word I have from people at these studios is that the cuts made don't make sense. They are not well thought out. They don't allow the studios to function correctly after the cuts. They are making stupid cuts. This is a pure numbers game from somebody that doesn't know what they're doing. And I think it's going to backfire. Mm-hmm. And I'm really, really disappointed by it all. I mean, I don't know what else to say. It's such a bummer.
There's one more statistic within Ash's email there, which is kind of telling, which is that 80% of Xbox is the console business. And that's a problem, right? Because they've spent so much time and effort in expanding into PC, and it's only account and indeed into towards other consoles, notably PlayStation 5, but Nintendo as well. But Xbox, the core business, is still 80% the console business. And we're looking at decisions here where, okay, some of them I think are probably inevitable. If they've basically got a bunch of in-house studios that were going to be essentially paid for by Game Pass, and Game Pass isn't working to that degree, then obviously there are going to be cuts from that perspective. But at the same time, if 80% of your core business is console related, I can't see anything within this that is going to actually improve their stance in the console space. And they're still facing the upcoming time bomb with Project Helix, where every leak about that console suggests, and in fact, Microsoft itself has officially said it's a premium experience, and the leaked specs suggest a premium a console. You know, I combine that with this. I don't understand how this reset is going to be able to change much, because, you know, it's going to take years to achieve, first of all. This is just the beginning. Secondly, you know, what is the scope of their first-party games, which are key to being, to sustaining a console? The seems to be that the audience for that particular console has been dwindling gen on gen. I mean, I don't understand what the future is. And this, you brought up the thing earlier, John, about 1 billion daily users for Xbox. There's 8 billion people in the world. The concept of one of every eight people across the world interacting with Xbox on a daily basis is like, you know, it's kind of Emperor's New Clothes stuff, isn't it? It's kind of just patently ridiculous. What's the strategy there? I just don't get it. All of this stuff, it seems to be about sort of gaming the numbers as opposed to actually coming up with a sustainable strategy. I'm just kind of sort of shocked by it all. One quick question for you, John. Machine Games doesn't seem to have been affected, which is kind of strange because they are effectively a sister studio to id Software.
Yeah, I'm completely confused by this, actually. I'm not sure what's going on there, and I hope that at least they've made it out okay. We don't yet know, I guess is what we should say.
Okay.
But gosh, I'm praying for those guys, man. They're amazing, too. They've done such great work.
Mm-hmm. Will, final thoughts?
I think, yeah, given that 80% is, you know, the console business, as you said, there's clearly more that could be done with PC. I feel like that is the Xbox brand's sole remaining strong point at this point against Nintendo and against Sony. They have, in theory, a direct line to the team that's making Windows, a direct line to the team that is making the Xbox app on PC. Like that, if that was a Steam level app and a Steam level ecosystem, then I would imagine it would be a lot easier for them to say, oh yeah, don't worry, you know, Project Helix is going to be fine because we're going to make more PC stuff, and that's where you can have the best experience. But right now that isn't the case. The Xbox app, I think for all of us, has been a source of frustration. And it's a shame. Like, they could be doing way more to make Windows better for gamers and make that Xbox brand stronger on Windows. The fact that Linux is becoming more popular and, you know, Valve is doing good things with SteamOS shows that there's huge room for improvement there. And if they want to turn the business around, maybe this is one area that they could invest more into and try and get a handle on that, because I feel like they're not really doing much with this huge advantage and this huge potential that they have.
And there's an interesting thing that you've put on your notes here is Xbox no longer for any of us. I think it's an interesting point, right? Because it seems to be the case that Gen 10 is going to be really, really difficult. And the decisions being made in the run-up to Gen 10 are basically all about sort of guarding revenue as opposed to coming up with a vision that's actually going to excite people about playing games. I mean, is there anything in this Asha Sharma email that says, okay, this is really, really tough decision-making. I can kind of understand it. But, you know, beyond that, why should we be excited about Xbox? That's it.
We shouldn't. And that's... I was going to say, though, Will, I mean, I think fundamentally one of the many problems here that you nailed there is that Microsoft, like, so it's like 80% on the console. Why did they fail at PC? It's because they don't know what they're doing in that front. Mm. It's so obvious. If you just sit down with the users and actually look at what they're doing, you'd understand the Microsoft gaming Xbox experience has been terrible for 20 years on their own OS that they own, right? Like, from Games for Windows Live to the Xbox app to UWP, like, every time they do this, there are problems. They don't know what they're doing with it. So you want to know why people aren't buying on their PC stuff or, like, engaging with it? It's because it sucks. They need to fix it. Maybe it's too late now. I don't know. But, like, it's always so obvious, like, when you just look at this, it's like, the experience is not good enough. There's a reason people are not using it, right? Like, we know, everyone knows. It's just a thing. Even people that aren't super hardcore, like, they know. They're annoyed with this stuff. Like, you've got to make a platform that people want to engage with to actually get people using it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Like, I went and I bought Forza Horizon 6 on Steam for a huge amount of money because it meant I didn't have to deal with the Xbox app, you know? Like, that's so silly to me that I could have had this game essentially for free because it's part of Game Pass. And I was like, nah, I'm going to use this on, you know, on a Steam handheld. I'm going to use this on other computers. And I can't be having just Xbox popping up with random errors every time I use it. Like, that's so, so silly to me. Like, that should just be an easy thing to fix, I would have thought. But...
I think just my sort of final point on this is that Asha Sharma's email tells us everything that's gone wrong with Xbox. And you kind of want hope for the future, right? And the hope for the future just isn't there. It's basically, okay, we're basically going to be decimating our remaining studios. But we want 1 billion players every day. It's just like... It's the wrong message to send, really, isn't it? It's kind of like, you know, we want to achieve more with less. And in the meantime, we're going to have a big bunch of our staff having the sword of Damocles hanging over them for the rest of the financial year. It's just kind of shocking. I don't think that the disconnect between the platform holders and gamers has ever been as big as it is here, what with the recent news, including the recent news from Sony as well. Shocking stuff. Okay. Now, we're going to go back in time 24 hours to our previous taping session and, I guess, carry on with Q&A. Right, okay, first question. Actually, I'm going to lump these two together because they are related. The first one comes from Code Malfunction. Hi, DF team. How scared should we be that the end of physical announcement from Sony did not come with an announcement for a disc-to-digital license program? Sony seems to be betting that people stay in their ecosystem because of their large digital libraries. But for people with large physical libraries like mine, this is a big reason to switch to another platform. I'm now considering building my own SteamOS machine to replace my PS5 Pro. While Steam is also digital only, Valve has an amazing track record on keeping my delisted games available. So while Sony actively blocked PT on PS5 and removes delisted movies from people's accounts, for example. Sorry, this is turning into a rant, but to get it back to a question, can we expect some kind of disc-to-digital program to be announced later? A question here from Ed. If Valve had said no other storefront apart from Steam is allowed on Steam Machine, I wonder how that might have impacted their antitrust case. Won't Sony and Microsoft now be doing exactly what Valve are being accused of unless they allow other storefronts? So, John, I'm going to come to you first on this one, because I think fundamentally what's happened here is, you know, as I mentioned in the Direct the other day, we had a three-paragraph blog post from Sony, which is basically going to upend the whole business model for PlayStation and affect a lot of users unduly. And what we didn't get from those three paragraphs was any kind of strategy on how this digital marketplace can actually accommodate people that want to do stuff like own their games, for example. Or, you know, let's talk about what Ed is talking about here about antitrust. You know, if we look back at what Epic was doing versus Apple and Google for their marketplaces, and the reason they differentiated against PlayStation, they said, well, PlayStation is subsidizing the platform. And so therefore, you know, it's not the same thing as Apple and Google. But if they're not going to be subsidizing the platform and they're going fully digital and curtailing the ability to buy games, sell games, own games, basically Sony has kind of like opened up a massive can of worms here. And I guess they've got until the end of 2027 to come up with a coherent strategy that is actually going to appease people as far as it's possible to appease them.
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult to know exactly what they could do. So the disc to digital thing that's been teased on, or at least sort of leaked and discussed on the Microsoft side, only seems feasible because, and weirdly, ironically, the 2013 Xbox One stuff with the disc, right, where every disc has its own like ID, there is a way to actually track that stuff. I don't know if that's the case on Sony discs. It probably is not. So there's likely no real way for that to work, I would imagine. So that's an interesting point to consider there. Like, yeah, if all of a sudden a huge chunk of your library doesn't come forward like a backwards compatibility situation, then it kind of removes that reason to stay committed to a certain brand, right? Just, if you want to keep it, keep your PS5 around, and then, you know, you can do whatever you want from there. So it's, this is such a weird thing because they haven't announced PS6. We can imagine this is because of that system. So how do they reveal this to the public without sort of like showing what they're doing for next generation? Like, that's, it's all of this is still unclear because they didn't present a business plan yet. They didn't try to sell anything to the consumer yet. It's just like, we're doing this, right? Mm-hmm. We don't know what they're thinking or what they're planning, but to this point, and I raised it in the direct, is like, there's just a lot of holes in Sony's system right now that make it not exactly a trustworthy place to spend a ton of money, I would say. So, and I mean, maybe it will become something like what's happened with, you know, Steam and antitrust. And I would imagine more likely we'll see maybe the EU step in again in attempt to regulate something. And I will say, I mean, EU regulations have actually had a positive influence on things, right? Most recently, there's the battery stuff. The right to repair, right, and being able to have swappable batteries. I think most people could agree that's actually a very good thing. So I would love for something to be done there. I mean, this is all still, there's so many unknowns right now, and it could go in many different directions.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I think they've got to upend everything that they're doing on the digital side if they're going to upend everything they're doing on the physical side, because obviously there are things happening there which represent fundamental curtailment of rights for people when they buy their games. This whole concept, I mean, it's kind of like almost poisonous at this point, the concept that you're buying these digital games, but you know you don't own them, and they could go. And that's not great at all. And then there is, of course, other things happening. For example, you know, I think unless there is, I mean, maybe it is the case that the additional revenues they're looking to get by going all digital will see a subsidized PlayStation 6. But they've been on the record as saying, actually, we don't want to do that. So it's really, really tricky there. And then you've got sort of external pressures. You know, we've already seen in the wake of the announcement last week, couple of European politicians wanting to actually take this further. I hope they do something there. But at the same time, they didn't do much for the Stop Killing Games campaign, which was a bit of a disappointment at the end of the day, wasn't it?
One of the things that's really interesting to me there, Rich, is like, and I guess they want to solve this with code in a box to some degree, but I was talking with a buddy here, like in Germany, for instance, you're not allowed to buy PSN cards or have a credit card when you're under 18, right?
Right.
So instantly having an account, an active account on PlayStation becomes more difficult, a barrier to entry for a lot of people. Code in the box stuff can help, I suppose. And that's probably the reason they would do it. But I still feel like they're building a system that's like kind of like it has additional friction that the younger audience may not want to deal with. That could cause a problem there. Though, again, maybe they're trying to just focus on their more quote unquote premium users, especially if this thing's rumored, you know, it's going to hit the price point that they've rumored. So I don't know. Just there's so many, and I saw other people talking about a lot of other countries, you know, like in Africa or countries like Australia where internet often sucks. And there's just a lot of issues still where internet limitations are still very much in effect. It's either very expensive, very slow, or both. And it makes downloading anything more than like a gigabyte, like untenable. So yeah, it just feels to me like they've decided from the math that, hey, we're willing to give up a lot of these customers because we want to make more money from our whales. And maybe maybe they'll succeed, but man, it sucks.
Will, thoughts?
I mean, yeah, it's just a hell of a situation, isn't it? I mean, I think that calculus is unfortunately the most likely explanation, right? That they kind of looked at things and said, well, you know, we might lose people in places where there's worse internet or where they can't afford to upgrade to the new console or where the EU is going to pass laws to make this impossible. But, you know, I guess that's fine. We'll make more money from everyone else. And therefore, you know, it'll be simpler and easier and more profitable for us in the long run. And that is obviously not a good thing in like a good versus evil kind of situation. But yeah, I mean, like math is really strong. It's a really strong argument to a lot of corporate people. So maybe that's just the way it went. I still think there's some room for innovation, some room for a technological solution to this. Like, could there be a way that you could sell your games back to the store, or you could sell it directly to other users and get some, you know, some money back? And then PlayStation also gets a bit of a cut from that, and therefore it's okay. Because I think otherwise, yeah, it is kind of a slam dunk in terms of antitrust and other kind of EU restrictions to say, oh yeah, suddenly for this generation, you can't sell your games, you can't, you know, lend them to a friend, you can't access them on these other machines. Like, it seems like there's way too many limitations, and it's likely to end up with some sort of governmental response. So yes, it's a silly situation.
Yeah, it's not great. I think it's basically the case now that all eyes are going to be on Sony and Microsoft to see you know, what the detail is on the Sony side. First of all, here's a question for you, John. Let's say the era of the disc is past, and I think that's probably the way things are going.
Yep.
Is there any kind of physical alternative that you'd be happy with that would stand, you know, not as a full replacement for the disc, because nobody's going to be shipping 100 gigs of data to end users from a retail store anymore. But is there any form of like physical device, maybe like some sort of USB key that you think would work better the code in the box?
I mean, absolutely. But I think the problem right now is just component costs are out of control. But I mean, Nintendo has that solution, right? And it's pretty good. And I feel
I don't think you could ship full games on these things. I'm talking about a physical item that is an entitlement.
So I don't love game key cards, but it's preferable to a one-time use code in a box by quite a bit. And, you know, again, not great for collectors, but it still gives you like a physical thing that you have some ownership over in terms of how you know what you do with it. You can sell it, you can do secondhand, again, stuff they probably want to kill. But it's better than Code in a Box. And yeah, some sort of like little thing like that, that you use with the system would potentially solve that. I mean, also even like NFC style stuff, I don't know, just something where like the ownership is tied to a physical item of some sort at least helps a little bit. It's just Code in a Box. It's just such a stupid thing because you're basically just making the thing for this like one-time use purpose. And I don't know. I really, really don't like Code in a Box at all. And, you know, even with Nintendo's solutions, we still occasionally see that. And that was actually one of the big things with the Switch 1 we found is like a lot of games that were carts initially became Code in a Box, but it was still like the people that wanted the cart could get it. And then like later sales would be Code in a Box. Like I think Cruise and Blast just got delisted or is about to be delisted. And most copies of that are Code in a Box, but there are actual carts out there. I have one and you can still get that, which is cool. But something like that, I think, is, you know, game key card style thing is probably our best bet, but I just don't see them doing it necessarily. I really think they're just all in on this digital stuff, and there's probably nothing we can do about it.
Well, John, tell you what, let's bring back the Hue card from the PC Engine.
The Hue card is one of the coolest formats that ever existed, I think, just as far as like, obviously, we could do way bigger storage now, but they're just beautiful little objects, right? There's what a cool thing. I love those Hue cards.
Will, I've got a question for you as well, which is this. You know, as a PC guy, something I've been talking about with John and the rest of the crew on DirectX is basically, you know, it does seem to be the case that console is just becoming more and more PC-like with each generation. And if we're now removing the concept of, you know, games you can buy from the shop, games you can share, that sort of thing. The dividing line between what a console is and what a PC is, plus the fact that the consoles are going to be hugely expensive. I mean, you know, I am wondering the extent to which, you know, there is a differentiation there and whether there is an opportunity for PC to actually increase market share substantially if the, basically the next generation consoles are going to be effectively very, very similar to the PC offering.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think this is, not to wade into the old arguments again, but I think this is why there is so much kind of upset about the Steam Machine and its price, is because I think a lot of people were looking at it and thinking, like, right, this could be it. This could be the thing that is enough like a console that I can acceptably put it in the living room. But also, you know, I can still get games at a good price. I can still get stuff on sale. I can get it from multiple marketplaces. I don't have to deal with all these other things. I think that idea has a lot more value when you have, you know, a PS6, which is looking like it's going to be very expensive and not support discs. And you have a Project Helix machine, which is going to be mostly a PC anyway. So why not get one a few years early kind of thing? So, yeah, I feel like that, yeah, that dividing line has certainly kind of eroded down to almost nothing. I guess, you know, Sony is still going to have its exclusive games. Nintendo are still going to have their own exclusive games that are going to be locked to that platform. But, you know, if you're not in, you know, you don't really like to play the specific genres that those companies are best at, then I'd say that line is eroded down to almost nothing these days.
Yeah, it's challenging. But something that could be a game changer, and Sony did actually allude to it recently, is that, you know, that basically they want to make the PlayStation a format that doesn't just live in the living room. And the implication from that is that it's going to tie into the handheld stuff that, you know, we've heard about. And John, I kind of think that this is probably going to be part of their charm offensive, to come out with a handheld that basically allows you to play your games from PS4, PS5, and PS6. It may well come out before the PlayStation 6.
It's basically
almost like a spearhead device to say, well, you know, here's our all-digital future. It's really, really awesome. It's this fantastic handheld that will play all your PlayStation 4 games, selected PlayStation 5 games, and going forward, PS6. So I think maybe that's part of the strategy that they can't announce yet.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of the thing, right? That's what I alluded to earlier, is that they don't have a product to talk about in terms of like what or why they're doing this. you know? Yeah. Which I guess makes the whole thing even trickier. We can certainly assume, though, that the handheld plays a role in this, right? On top of everything else happening in the industry. But yeah, they're not going to spin discs in a handheld. So coming up with some sort of solution to ensure that it's works seamlessly, I guess, is important. I don't know, man. We'll see.
Yeah, it's depressing. I mean, everything is... The situation is that... what can you say? The whole sort of technological landscape at the moment is in a state of chaos. So I suspect there's probably going to be a few more shocks along the way. But let's move on. Question here from Cynthia Sizer. That's a great handle. Hello, Rich and friends. One thought on your recent discussion about the dangerous state of the games industry. So apparently affordable hardware can't really be manufactured anymore in the near future, and progress is being stifled by stagnating RAM and SSD sizes. Would it be so bad if manufacturers called their future consoles off, told game studios to focus on current gen, and just quote-unquote froze technology for a decade? Wow, a decade.
Wow.
A decade. So, assuming consoles coming out in late 2027, actually 2037, that's quite remarkable. Anyway, or is the nature of the business that it always has to advance? Thank you for consistently great episodes, exclamation point. I'm going to go to you first on this one, Will, because it's a refrain we've heard on social media quite a lot, which is basically delay the next generation consoles, delay them because they're just going to be too expensive. Should there be a delay? Should there be more of a focus on what's currently out there?
I mean, it's already kind of happened, right? Like, we're already seeing the cross-gen generation the cross-gen period has become a lot longer than it has historically. Maybe we'll get to a point where the PS6 comes out and people are still making games for the PS5 and the PS4, right? It could be that we have three generations. Well, yeah, but if you're coming out with a game which is meant to be more multiplayer, is not taxing, then maybe it'll happen, right? Yeah, it's definitely impossible to say, yeah, we'll just call everything off because things are expensive right now. Because, if you're Sony, if you're Microsoft, you're spending a lot of money on R&D trying to get these things ready. And you kind of need it to come out at some stage so that people can actually give you money for it, and therefore you can recoup your investment. And, you can potentially delay things a little bit if you think, oh yeah, RAM is going to get way cheaper next year. Sure. But, the silicon is probably set in stone, and therefore the later it comes out, the more kind of behind it'll be. Because it's a console, it's never going to be bleeding edge anyway. So yeah, I think there's a lot of factors that kind of push the generations to keep happening, even if the market conditions aren't really ideal. And maybe they just come out as kind of halo devices for enthusiasts who can pay whatever they want for a new generation, and they're happy to do that, and everyone else stays on the previous gen.
What do you think about this, John? Delay, if so, for how long?
I suspect no delay, simply because the component prices for the current systems are also expensive, right? And the parts that are so expensive are pretty similar between them, so it's I would imagine, so it's likely not to save much money. Personally, I wouldn't mind a large delay. This really kind of makes me rethink the whole thing anyway, because I feel like at this point, PlayStation 6, whatever, it's essentially for us, it's a work object, right? Like, it's something to cover on Digital Foundry and examine it, rather than something where I'm like personally super excited for it. So I guess not delaying it would be good for us in a way, because it gives us something to talk about that's new and different hardware-wise. But as far as what I personally want, I don't care at this point. If they delay it or not delay it, it's kind of whatever.
Hasn't a large focus of your gaming moved on to PC anyway at this point?
So yes and no. So depends on what it is. And in a lot of cases, it's kind of weird how that's worked out. Like, for instance, it was like Resident Evil 9 and Pragmata. I actually did play through those both on PC and console, but I actually also bought disc versions of it despite having access to our PC version, So it's still something, you know, I want to own. And when it comes to like replaying it, sometimes it just depends on where I'm in the mood for it. And some games I think are just better suited for playing on a console. But yeah, if I have to choose and like have like, here's a digital game, where are you going to play it? Then it makes sense to just go ahead and do it on PC, right? Because it's a more open format. You know, I'm not worried about long-term ownership. But also, like, I'm not really, like, this gets to the whole, like, okay, what are you going to do about this in the future? It's like, I don't want to give up playing games. I still love the games, regardless of how they ship, right? But it does impact what I buy, how I buy it, and where. You know what I mean? And it'll probably just mean, unfortunately, some titles, it's more like the AA stuff and some of the AAA stuff that I'm very likely to just skip out on now. I'm always ready to support indies digitally, smaller titles, because I think that stuff, you know, that's actually one of the few benefits to the digital marketplace I will concede, is that it did make these types of games, smaller games, much more viable in a way that wasn't true when it was just physical media, right? Like, you can have these $20 or less games, no problem now. You couldn't really do that before, which is just cost prohibitive. So that's why I actually like a mix of the two. I think having options is what's great here. So, but a lot of it's just like, there's this big wait and see, like, what's going to happen, how habits will change. Yeah, it's a weird one.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about, you know, the nuts and bolts of how a console is made, right? We've got a crazy situation at the moment where the actual SoCs cost, I mean, I'm assuming it would have gone up compared to prior generations, right? But that stuff would have been factored into Sony and Microsoft's equations when they designed the units. However, the RAM and SSD sizes wouldn't have been. Mm-hmm. So, you know, basically the situation here is that there is a chance that you could actually make a cost efficient console, which probably wouldn't be that much more expensive than the current generation consoles, but would probably have similar amounts of memory and similar SSD sizes. So then the focus shifts to what can this SoC do? And we know what the SoCs are going to be doing next generation, because it's essentially Zen 6 and RDNA 5, if everything we've learned is true. And certainly on the RDNA 5 side, we've got the video with Jack Ewan and Mark Cerny, which basically signposts that's the technology. And, you know, there's opportunities there to produce an SoC that is smaller, that punches above its weight in a similar way to Switch 2, but more so because it is a home console. But because it's leveraging stuff like machine learning based super sampling and better ray tracing. So again, I'm still thinking about the APU that's going to be in the PlayStation handheld, you know, and whether that could be repurposed into a set-top box for the living room that would effectively replace the PlayStation 5 and be capable of doing better things. But, you know, it would still be relatively affordable to make. I'm curious about that. I'm curious as to whether it's going to happen, or whether PlayStation rather would just go all in on a Switch type strategy, which is probably the better solution for them, to be honest. Properly differentiate themselves. PlayStation 5 stays where it is. But, you know, in terms of this concept of freezing technology, you just got to look at what Switch 2 is doing. I mean, John, imagine what Switch 2 would be like without DLSS. Imagine that Resident Evil Requiem was on Switch 2, but it was native 540p docked. It wouldn't be a pretty thing, would it? But but it's a great example of you know, you don't need to ramp up shaders to produce a really good output. You can actually use advances in technology to sort of skirt your way around the limitations there. The issue, I think, is that basically it's probably too late In terms of like the designs of the core consoles, like PlayStation 6 and Project Helix, those designs would have been set in stone. We'll talk about that in the next question, years ago. But, you know, I'm kind of still wondering. I mean, Microsoft were talking about a family of devices, and the nature of the SoC that they've got is such that they could, you know, retain the SoC side, and then you've got a GPU side that could be swapped with another RDNA 5 part. So I'm curious as to what's going to happen there, because they obviously need to do something, and leveraging on cutting edge features, I think it's probably a smart move. Anyway, let's move on. Jose asks, hello gents, exclamation point, lot of discussion on component pricing on next gen hardware. Is your expectation that PS6 SoC is still being designed? I would have guessed the specs were already locked. So John, I'm going to go back to the meeting we had with Microsoft in March 2020, where we were kind of wondering about the hotel, terrified we'd get COVID.
Oh my that? Freaking God, yeah.
But the high point, well, one of the high points with that meeting was that we did meet Andrew Goosen, the chief architect of the Xbox Series consoles. And that interview, I think, is probably one of the most honest technological interviews and transparent technological interviews we've had for some time. You know, because basically he was telling us, hey, these consoles, they're not going to be cheap to make going forward. I don't think even he anticipated that we'd be looking at a $750 Series X 6 years later, but here we are. But one of the things that was being discussed was the fact that the design for the Xbox Series X SoC was basically locked in 2016, 4 years before it came out.
Right.
So this gives you an idea of timelines on how long it takes to design a console. So to answer Jose's question, is the PS6 SoC still being designed? Almost certainly not, right?
Yeah, I suspect a lot of this stuff is already kind of locked, and you know, developers are starting to get their hands on it, or at least the information is going out about what it is. So it does create this feeling of momentum, and that's probably one of the biggest problems they faced here, is that while they were designing this thing, the AI bubble went nuts. I say bubble, let's hope it's a bubble, but we don't know yet. But AI went nuts, and cost of components went through the roof. And I'm not sure how you handle that internally, because they're already heading down a path, but you can't really just like pull all the way back and rethink everything, right? At that point.
No,
not when you're already that far in, but it does, all of it hinges on components that are becoming increasingly expensive. So they're kind of stuck and locked into it. And I'm sure they've just spent a lot of time finding ways to mitigate these problems as best as they can. And I'm sure this disc stuff is possibly part of it. You know, like it's all just like, all right, how are we going to sell this thing? How can we even afford to make it? Like, what's the plan here? We can't really delay it. We can't really do a different box without like massively setting things back. So it's a really tough position to be in right now.
Yeah. I mean, the issue is that there are certain things that can be controlled and certain things that can't be controlled. If you assume that the SoC is basically a lock at this point, you have control over other parts of the system. So going back to Xbox One, they mildly overclocked the CPU and the GPU compared to the initial spec, because, you know, they found that they had the headroom to do that. Sony, I mean, it has been denied that they went from 4 gigabytes to 8 gigabytes, but you know, I have seen internal documentation where the spec for the PlayStation 4 rather was 4 gigabytes, and then it was announced with 8. So that was a situation where, you know, they just, I guess, effectively swapped to higher capacity modules. So there are options there. In terms of what can happen with the PlayStation 6 and Project Helix, the rumors are basically saying that the bus for PlayStation 6 can theoretically allow up to 40 gigabytes, potentially 30 gigabytes. And then there's Helix, which is apparently higher owing to a wider memory interface, up to 48 gigabytes potentially. But it could be, you know, 36, whatever. I'm wondering whether we'll actually see a downgrade on memory this time around rather than the original specs. And I do think that there's potential leeway there, because, you know, all of this stuff about neural texture compression hasn't really come to anything at the moment. And that's a sort of curious state of affairs. Surely they could do something there, you know, make more with what you've got, basically. Will, thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty logical avenue to at least explore. I think, you know, in terms of the architecture of recent PlayStation consoles, they have been a little bit more hands-on in terms of trying to have specialized hardware to do very specific things. And so maybe this is one thing that they can, you know, spend extra, you know, add on like a little extra piece that just makes these things a little bit more efficient and allows them to get away with less RAM or a smaller SSD or something like that. Those parts are still going to be in flux and it's still possible for them to make changes there. But it might just be that, you know, like everyone else, they'll say, well, we'll make the money back eventually. And it's just going to have to be a way more expensive console than we originally planned. Because if everyone else is doing it, then, you know, you don't look like the odd one out, at least, even if people only looking at your product won't really understand.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Let's move on. Question here from Skyrim Fest 26 FPS edition. Do you like the sound of a Super FX or 32X style upgrade for today's consoles to eke out a bit more life from them? PS5 has PCIe Gen 4 lanes exposed to SSD, so you could hang something interesting off of that. Switch 2 is harder, but could 10 gigabyte per second or get 10 gigabits per second USB be enough to add something neat to the dock or the cartridge port? Or is Star Fox just making me feel overly nostalgic? What do you think, Will? I mean, I guess theoretically it's possible. The PlayStation 5 does have a PCIe Gen 4 interface, which you use for the NVMe. You could potentially put some sort of accelerator in there.
Yeah.
It's just the concept of people having to manually upgrade their PlayStation 5s is probably too onerous. And secondly, anything that happens off chip introduces a huge degree of latency. But, you know, we have seen expansion cards before and that interface is there.
Yeah, it's a really funny idea. Like, you know, you could legitimately, probably more as a hack than, you know, as a project than something that Sony is out there endorsing. But yeah, maybe you could put something on there that gives you frame gen, possibly.
Right.
If you assume that, you know, frame gen is already adding some amount of latency. So if you add another 10 minutes of latency, does that matter?
10 minutes. That would matter, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. It's probably not at all viable, but I'd love to see a kind of community project on that. Maybe with PS5 Linux, it's possible that people can start plugging stuff in there and seeing what's possible.
What do you think, John?
I think there's no purpose.
Shades of the Saturn expansion was.
Exactly. I think that doesn't make any sense these days. Like back in the past, you could argue that like adding functionality, even though it largely wasn't successful, was at least interesting because hardware was so very specific in terms of how it was designed and it did open up new avenues for things that would otherwise be completely impossible. But now, like, everything's possible, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's really just about improving fidelity of what we already have. We're not seeing any, like, major changes that would warrant this, I would say. The hardware's good enough. It's all about the games and the software.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, yeah, not too much to add to that. And that was the last question of the show, therefore the end of the show. So please do like, subscribe, share on the off chance you enjoyed it. Ring bells for notifications, that sort of stuff. DF supporter program, patreon.com/digitalfoundry. Join us there. It's amazing stuff. But that's all from us on this one. I guess we'll see you soon, probably in the next direct. Thanks for watching.